Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So I spent part of last night checking out some world news headlines about food. Listen to what I found in part. From UPI, the new Egypt needs food. From the BBC, Bolivian President Evo Morales flees food price protest. From Fox News Latino, Puerto Rican farmers warn of coming food shortages. From the Baltimore Sun, the U.S.-driven food crisis behind Mideast revolutions. From the National Post in Canada, Chinese hoarding drives up food prices, economists warns. From the Examiner in D.C., China's drought could affect global wheat supply. And most heartbreaking of all, from the Daily Nation in Kenya, schools face closure as food shortage worsens. It's a warning from two school districts in another drought-stricken nation. More and more, we're hearing about natural disasters, economic trends, and policy choices that are creating a world food shortage. How bad is it? Is it driving the protest movements from Egypt to Latin America? We just heard on the news about wholesale food prices going up. What needs to be done? With me now is an expert on food pricing and market reform activist. He is Raj Patel, author of The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Hello, Raj. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be back, Brian.
What about that headline on Chinese hoarding? Should we start there?
Well, sure. I mean, the issue here is that we live in a world with globally connected markets. Markets that stretch across the world in a way that's tighter than they've been in a very, very long time. And so when, for example, there's a crop failure, when there is a drought, for example, as there is in China, when there are failed harvests, as there are in China, that ripples across the world. And that's an example of how just an event that in the past might have been localized to one specific region now has global repercussions. I mean, we saw this happen last year as well, where as a result of once-in-a-century heat waves in Russia, there were international repercussions of that, and there were food rebellions in Mozambique as a result of, you know, what was going on in Russia because the price of wheat went much higher. So, yes, I mean, we can, I mean, the era of these large-scale international events in food markets rippling globally is very much upon us.
How bad is it?
Well, it depends who you are. I mean, you may have noticed in the U.S., we aren't seeing rebellions happening around the world, in the country so far. But globally, the number of people who are in extreme poverty is, the World Bank just announced, went up by 44 million to just shy of 1 billion people. So, you know, 1 in 7 human beings now live in extreme poverty. And certainly, according to the United Nations, over 925 million people are undernourished, just don't get enough food every day. Now, in part, of course, it's been this bad for a very long time. And before the food crisis in 2008, for example, when everyone started worrying about food prices, the number of people who weren't getting enough to eat in the world was about 800 million. And that seemed to be okay. We seemed to be all right with that for some reason. But now that number is creeping higher and its effects are politically much more seismic. We seem to be paying much more attention here in the United States.
And listeners, if you have roots anywhere in the world outside the United States, are you hearing about a food crisis, a food shortage, a serious spike in the price of food in the country that you come from? Give us a call if this sounds like you or something you know about. 212-433-WNYC or anyone else on the world food price spike, the world food shortage, what more people now are calling the world food crisis. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. But I would love to hear from anybody, immigrants from anywhere, who have roots anywhere in the world where this is really breaking out as a factor in politics and survival, in the economy, anything. 212-433-WNYC, 9692 as we talk about growing awareness of a world food crisis with Raj Patel, visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies, a fellow at the group Food First, and author of the book The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. 212-433-9692 or post to our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Raj, do you think food shortages are a factor behind the democracy winter in the Middle East?
I think they are. I mean, if we look at where it all started, which was Algeria, there were large where protests initially broke out, although there hasn't been the same kind of overhaul of the government. One of the driving factors was an increase in food prices. And that's a global phenomenon. The United Nations has a food price index that it's been monitoring for a few decades, and it's at its highest level ever. Now, of course, high food prices are not by themselves a guarantee that governments will fall. Because if it were, then we would see overhauls in the government in India or in China, for example. I was in India just a couple of months back, and food inflation there was at 18% for that month. And people were taking to the streets. There were protests. But it's certainly the case that higher food prices combined with other things are, if you like, revolutions kindling. The food price spike can spark something that can turn into this kind of democratic overhaul. But it was other factors as well. I mean, the food prices were high, but also unemployment was chronically high too. And one of the things that Ben Ali did, for example, one of his last things in Tunisia, was to drop the price of food. Of course, that didn't help because unemployment was still high. So the price of food was lower, but people still had no money in their pockets. There are other factors too, of course. Inequality matters, and the fact that governments are now walking back from the entitlements that poor people have also matters in a time when food prices are going higher, because poor families spend proportionally much more of their income on food. So when you hear about food price inflation, even in the United States, it depends. I mean, it may not matter for the average middle class American family, but it certainly matters if you're on the poverty line here or anywhere else in the world.
Did you know about that BBC headline I read? Evo Morales fleeing food price protests in Bolivia.
I had heard about that, and that gives you a sense of, firstly, I mean, Evo Morales was himself a peasant farmer. He was a coca farmer. He actually set himself the task of trying to combat these the food price spikes. But when it has escaped even his grasp, it gives you a sense of quite how difficult it is to battle back against this sort of global system of markets, but also how hard it is to make sure that the entitlements of poor people, particularly in rural areas, are met.
We're getting phone calls from people with ties to places all over the world. Let's hear some of these stories. Ahmad in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ahmad.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Good, thank you.
I like your show because your show have a different kind of variety and different topic. You went to Pakistan recently, and I see the prices of the food is very, very high. Number one is a big reason because it's a flood. And second reason is because I give you example that onion is a shortage in China and India. So they are smuggled onion from Pakistan. And then Pakistani people paying very high price for onion because the food is smuggled to that other countries. And that other point is because that is a subsidy of the farmers is not that great. So people are not paying attention for that much for their own land. To grow something.
Ahmad, thank you very much. I'm in Naka in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Yes, you're on.
Hi. Well, my mother grew up in Sierra Leone, West Africa. And when she was growing up, my grandfather was in the military, and each military officer, no matter what kind of rank, would get a bag of rice every month.
Right.
And I mean, there was so much food, and there was well, and then after the war. The Blood Diamond War, the food and the rice is a staple food of that country. No, I mean, it's like an arm and leg now. I mean, you have to pay for water. The water that we get here in New York free to drink a lot of people are wasting, they have to pay for it. And it's sad to see.
Has it gotten much worse in the last couple of years?
Yeah, it's gotten worse. I mean, I see some of my friends that don't have enough, my own age group don't have enough food to eat, and it's just sad to sit there and see that.
Thank you so much for your call. It is heartbreaking. Janice in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning.
And?
Can you hear me?
Yes, Janice. You're just back from Jamaica, I understand?
Just back from Jamaica. My husband and I were on holiday, and we were staying in villas, so we were buying our food. Considering the minimum wage in Jamaica is just $50 a week, and we're spending $10 on a half a chicken in the grocery store, I don't understand how these people can live.
Thank you. Kate in Montclair. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hi. I'm from Australia, and I just wanted to say that, you know, we're very fortunate in the U.S. to not be affected by the cost of food to the extent that they are in the rest of the world. You know, in Australia, they've suffered droughts, obviously not this year because of the floods, but droughts have been a common problem, and that's constantly affecting, you know, crops and the cost of food. And I'm always surprised when I go back that, you know, the grocery shopping that I would do in Australia versus is always so much higher, about 80% more costly for a family of four when I go there to visit my family.
Thank you. One more. Zuhair in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you, Brian Lehrer? I like your show. Actually, I'm calling. I'm from Niger. I live in New York City.
Uh-huh.
As you know, the case of Niger has been reported by Auckland Institute, and there is a fascinating review they have on it, which is named like Sahel, the prisoner of starvation. Very interesting things about Niger. As you know, like in Niger, we have like 2 years in a row we have starvation, 2009 and 2010. And now with this food crisis, I'm following it, and the things are going bad over there. And I wanted also to make a difference between some, like the food security and the food, you know, the
shortage.
Yeah. So like in here, in the Western country, when we're talking about hunger and food security, we're talking about like the eating qualities. Like in my country, in Niger, we don't talk about quality. We talk about quantity. Like people don't need quality over there. They don't even have the quantity to eat.
Nobody's debating Whole Foods versus C-Town over there.
Yeah, actually, you know, over there, you know, right now things are going bad because, like, when I left like 7 years ago, the bag of the rice was like $10 U.S. money, but mm-hmm. right now with like $25, you know, this is to eat rice in my country is like living in the good area, you know.
Unbelievable, Zubair. Thank you very much. Horrible stories, as we're hearing from all over the world. We have many more callers that we could go on and take more heartbreaking stories. My guest is Raj Patel, author of The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy, and he's with the group Food First. So, Raj, you've been hearing these stories. I'm sure they don't surprise you. Of course, in New York, we can get every single corner of the world represented with people calling in. Can I go down a list of factors that I've heard mentioned in relation to the shortages that we just heard documented? For example, the growing middle classes in emerging nations, especially China and India, simply more demand for more food, creating shortages around the world and driving up prices. Might that have an impact on what we heard from Niger or Jamaica, for example?
It's certainly true that people in China and in India and in other middle-income countries are starting to want more of the things that we eat here because our companies are over there selling them the kinds of things we eat here. But that doesn't directly translate into the low wages that we see in Jamaica, for example. And rice, you know, the demand for rice, and in fact rice stocks at the moment are looking pretty good. So it's unfair to blame rising incomes in developing countries for the sort of chronic squeeze. The acute squeeze. I mean, it's true that there's an upward trend, but blaming India and China right now seems to miss some of the more important factors.
All right. What about the very unusual weather in the last year? A once in 200 years drought in China's breadbasket, as I read it on one site. Drought in Russia, usually a wheat exporter, now mm-hmm. importing wheat. I read the floods in Australia that we heard from that caller, the weather, as a driving factor in the last couple of years.
Well, that certainly matters, Brian. Although we can't ascribe a particular weather event to climate change, we are seeing so many extreme weather events that it's hard not to suspect the hand of climate change behind this. But the thing is that extreme weather events are not new in human history. Some people are blaming, for example, the La Nina weather cycle. But the reason that we have a name for La Nina and El Nino is because they do happen so regularly. Human history is that humans are very familiar with sort of weird extreme weather events. What's different now, though, is that in the past we used to prepare for weather events. You know, we used to understand that there may be seven fat years and then seven lean years, and we would have things like grain stores, and we would have mechanisms to ensure that people were able to weather out shortages. Unfortunately, because we've liberalized markets and gotten rid of the grain stores, you know, in the United States that happened under Clinton, but globally it has happened from the 1980s on under the sort of neoliberal economic policy. Because we've managed to snip away at all the safety nets that human civilization kind of put in place to manage the weather, that's why the weather matters so much. So it's true that extreme weather events are happening, but the important question to ask is not why are extreme weather events happening, but why do they hurt us so much more now than they used to in the past?
And there are two other theories that pin some blame on the United States. One for subsidizing biofuels like ethanol, which convert the grain stock from human food to vehicle food, creating grain shortages. And the other is about Ben Bernanke's quantitative easing policy at the Fed, his massive treasury bond buyback, which devalues the dollar, driving investment into commodities, including foods, driving up the price. Are you into either of those?
Certainly, I mean, it's not just the United States that subsidizes biofuels. The European Union does it too, and that's a very real factor, particularly when the price of oil is going up, because that also is a contributing factor to the price rises. And I think it is true that by making money easily available, traders are doing what they're paid to do, which is to take cheap money and put it into places where there is a return to be found. And so, again, the interesting question is not why are traders doing what they're paid to do, which is to speculate on commodities, but why do we allow commodity speculation to happen on the things that are most vital for human survival.
Laurie in Bedford, you're on WNYC. Hello, Laurie.
Yeah. Nobody in here, but they must be all.
Laurie, can you hear me? Your family's in Kenya, is that right?
Yes.
Go ahead, Laurie, you're on the air. You have family in Kenya?
Yes, I do. My father lives in Nanyuki, north of Nairobi, but the news all for the last week was about, especially about the food shortages and starvation and lack of water in Potok in particular. But my only comment really was that the schools are where people are leaving their kids, hoping that they'll get food, they'll get water, and moving on to other places to hopefully get food and jobs. If these schools close, I don't know what's going to happen to the kids, because they're actually acting as orphanages right now. There is no water. Nobody's got water for boiling rice or maize or corn. And the government has promised food for weeks and is withholding it, I guess. So there are major food shortages. So those are my only comments.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Is that on the government of Kenya, as far as you're concerned, Raj, or does that require an international response? I'm sure that's the worst story we've heard yet.
Well, I mean, sadly, it's both. I mean, certainly and this is a systematic thing that the governments, particularly in times like this, tend to worry more about what their urban populations are going to do than their rural populations. And urban populations are the ones who are most likely to take to the streets and cause these kinds of democratic changes. Whereas rural populations are the one most likely to be going hungry and the ones who are most likely to be starving. And tragically, this is an international phenomenon. It's not just the government of Kenya, though the government of Kenya is certainly culpable in its own domestic affairs. But there's a trend towards cutting the already low entitlements to poor rural people to try and stave off stave off poverty in urban areas. And there's always been a rural-urban bias towards urban areas. But right now, that means that already in rural areas where hunger is rife, things are getting much, much tighter.
Well, I'm sorry to say we are out of time, but hopefully we've done a little to raise people's awareness of the growing world food crisis, world food shortage taking place right now. Maybe the worst stories coming out of several countries in Africa, what we heard from Kenya, what we heard from Niger, this morning, and there are others certainly that you could find online. Because this isn't affecting the United States so acutely, it doesn't get that much coverage here right now, but this is one of the biggest things going on in the world at this moment, and I'm glad we were able to spend our lead story on it this morning with Raj Patel from the group Food First and UC Berkeley, author of The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. And by the way, Raj, before you go, in honor of there being a new White House press secretary today, former Time magazine correspondent Jay Carney, we are asking most of our guests today, what's the first question you would ask the new spokesman for Obama? You got one?
Well, I'd ask him why, when we know the real causes behind this food crisis, why the U.S. continues to support market liberalization and a vision for feeding the world that involves markets and the private sector rather than sustainable agriculture that farmers in the world have been demanding.
Raj, thanks a lot. Thanks again
coming
on. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And listeners, we have this set up on our Facebook page and on our politics website. It's a free country. .org in honor of Jay Carney taking over as White House press secretary today from Robert Gibbs. And we're going to try to get him on the show. He used to come on the show when he was congressional correspondent for Time magazine. We'll see if he deigns to make an appearance now as White House press secretary, Jay Carney. But since this is his first day on the job, we are inviting you on our politics website, it's freecountry.org, to post your first question for a new White House press secretary. Go to itsafreecountry.org. You'll see it right there. And by the way, we will stream live on It's a Free Country, Jay Carney's first press briefing at 12:30 this afternoon. But coming up next, New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn. Stay with us.